So just befriend the weak. And break another heart this doing a recap of the NXT TakeOver show. Of course, I'm Pete. And of course, I'm still joined by Tim. Tim, how's it going, man?
It's going good, going good. Yeah, I got a heading out of town this weekend, and it kind of made sense. I feel like the TakeOver specials always kind of throw off our recording weeks, and so yeah. It kind of worked out where it was like, hey, we can just grab it, watch it here, so we have something coming out this week. You don't have to wait 2 weeks to hear our takes on the TakeOver. Especially, this was a really good TakeOver, so I'm happy that
It was. And like Tim said, he's going to be gone this week. I'm then heading out to Atlanta and Chattanooga for Action Wrestling and the Making Town show and the Scenic City Rumble. So I'll be gone for that. So I'm super excited about that. My boss has cleared me officially for Mania, so I bought my flight into Philly, because I'll be road warring it with Johnny P, and then it drops like hours after I announced I booked my Philadelphia flight. Freddie Ahai versus Daniel Maccabee at Pizza Party, or whatever the hell the damn show is. Is it Pizza Party?
Yeah, Pizza Party. Pro wrestling, right?
So I text Johnny P. I'm like, dude, I'm landing at 3:50. Can we make this show? And the answer was yes. So the tickets go on sale February 1st. So guys, if you're out there, you guys, and you're gonna be in there Wednesday in New Jersey, this could be the sleeper of all the matches. This is a Freddie Ahai when I in Dallas. Was kind of a breakout type of guy. I'm thinking Daniel Maccabee. He has a shot to be a breakout type of guy Mania weekend. I think Freddie Ahai might be like a perfect opponent for him. What do you think?
Yeah, I can't think of... I mean, other than just me personally, for different reasons, I really want to see him and Robbie Eagles against each other.
Okay, and Robbie Eagles was on that show too.
Yeah, and that's for a whole different reason. That's just because I know their history and friendship with each other, and just cool matchup on paper. But Yehi, I mean, Yehi has that same background, let's say, you know, and Yehi was a bit of a natural to the pro wrestling because of his previous experiences, let's say, in wrestling. So, them two going at it. I mean, yeah, on paper, I can't think of a better matchup. You know, there's the dream matchup of John Gresham as well, I think, that a lot of people want to see. And Gresham. And I think that, you know, I think that will be coming. But I think that otherwise, I mean, yeah, I think Yehi is... He's high on the list of people that I would pick. And especially now, with the way Yehi is working, we've talked about it, but with his kind of, or I've talked about it, I don't know. Yeah, I think you've seen it. He's kind of more aggressive, more grumpy, a little bit heavier striking style. So getting to have Maccabee show off some of his grappling techniques against a more rough neck, rough fighting type of Yehi might be fun. And hey, you know, Yehi might break out some of that old skills that he had on the mat when he's going up against a fierce competitor like Yehi when it comes to that mat rest, or like Maccabee when it comes to the mat rest.
Yeah, like a Slim J type of
yeah, that's true.
Mat work. I'm super stoked. I mean, when I saw that, I was like, okay, you gotta be effing kidding me. Of course I'm going to this fucking show. Right.
And you know, people who know meet my other podcasts will know the person running the show has been on both my podcasts, Dan Scotty, great guy. Super, you know, into the wrestling scene too, and has a sensibility that I think it's funny because he's not online. He's not a big, you know, online Twitter wrestling fan, but he is into the same kind of stuff that, you know, us, the hardcore Twitter wrestling fans are into, you know, but he's just not even, he's more of a WWE guy and always has been, but the stuff that he does like from the indies and stuff is the stuff that everyone like, you know, is really into. So
yeah, and then Bloodsport looks like it's really shit rounding out really well, so That has another chance of just having a kick-ass show. I love Mania Weekend because everyone really, I mean, people work hard naturally, but they really, I mean, they really want to be noticed on Mania Weekend. It's kind of like, you know, it's kind of performing on Broadway in a way, or, you know, just a big, it's just a big, because most of the guys here at Mania Weekend don't get a chance to wrestle in front of this large of crowds and stuff either, for the most part.
Right.
I'm not saying all the guys, but a lot of them and stuff. But it's just, you know, it's just funny, you know, where here we are. I'm you know, salivating over Yehi and Maccabee. And then, yeah, it's on the same show, we're going to get Dick Justice, who I could, you know, I could give a flying fuck about. You know, he has his purpose, though, and he does entertain to a lot of people, and just not me. So, but that's not a knock or anything like that.
Exactly. I mean, Dick, you know, that's going to be a very interesting show. Like I said, the guy running the show, Dan, I know personally, and I know that he's got a very interesting opinion on stuff in general too. He's you know, one of these big time Great Khali fans, you know, he's one of those, so he's got a sense of humor too, and he likes a lot of,
yeah, well, we'll see how disciplined he is with it. I find it interesting too, you know, I mean, obviously he's smart enough to book a Yehi Maccabee match, but also, you know, Dick Justice does serve a purpose on a show. Now it's got to be important that he doesn't book four comedy matches or whatever, you see what happens, you know. So I have faith. Hopefully he doesn't do that. And I'm pretty sure he won't. I mean, if you're smart enough to book Yehi Maccabee, you should be smart enough not to book a bunch of comedy matches on the same, excuse me, on the same show. So yeah.
It's definitely going to, I mean, the name is perfect. It's going to be a big party, I think, is the for sure thing. And you mentioned Maccabee having a chance to be a breakout over the weekend. He's got some matches already announced, but he's got a big match, I think, happening this weekend. It'll be live streaming on Indie TV in Black Label Pro. And he put a little promo video out there. I don't know if you saw
the
promo.
I have not.
The video that for his match against Rory Gulak. We'll just say it's interesting. Maccabee's got his own style, obviously, and I kind of like it as a way to introduce him to more fans outside of the bubble. So, you know, he's playing his guitar. It's all silent, basically, except for the noise coming from the feedback on his guitar, because Dan's also a musician. Like, people don't, maybe they realize that you can tell from his vibe that he's into it, but he also plays in a band that's actually toured and stuff. So he's, like, you know, showing everyone, instantly getting an idea of, like, the guy, the person behind just the wrestler. And I think that that's pretty cool, and it's unique, and it kind of stands out. So hopefully that'll help with kind of introducing him more and more to different crowds. Cause I think WrestleMania weekend could be the weekend where, if he already has a little bit of buzz from stuff like this online and the Black Label Pro match and stuff like that, and then when it gets into Mania weekend, you know, I've kind of heard of this guy, or, oh, you know, people have talked about this guy, and then a lot more people start to see him. I think that he could break out in a way. Not necessarily, you know, he's not going to be the next Matt Riddle, but he's definitely has a chance to be someone that people start paying attention to more.
Yeah, a guy who, you know, you start seeing on you know, in a lot more indies. Getting a lot more chances. That's what I hope to come out of this for Dan. Royal Rumble. Did you happen to watch any of that?
I have watched none of it, and I've thought about it, but I haven't.
Okay, 7 hours, long show. Oof. I mean, people are complaining online, long, you know, the pregame and all this. Now, if you go into a WWE pay-per-view and you're buying a ticket and you know they're running two Rumble matches, okay, that's on you. You bought that ticket, you should know better because it's long. For me, if you don't want to watch all 7 hours, just don't. Then boom, okay? Yeah. If you're at home, you can easily not have to watch it until you want to start watching it, you know? So I can understand that. I still think it's insane to run two Rumble matches on the same show. And, I mean, my God, they did the Women's Rumble, which, well, I didn't think it was particularly good until the finish, and that was amazing, and it was a great story. But, you know, Becky goes over. Then we follow up with a Daniel Bryan AJ style match, and that match was incredible, for several reasons. one, it was some great limb work, and yeah, it was a match I think you would like. But my God, the crowd did not give a flying fuck, or they were combined burnout, didn't give a fuck about limb work. People who complain about Ciampa and Aleister Black's limb work not getting any reactions. That was a five-star burner for crowd reactions if you compared it to AJ and Daniel, who were working so hard and having a really strong psychology of limb work match, storytelling match, and the crowd either was burnt out or didn't give a fuck. Because when you do these Rumbles live, have you ever been to a Royal Rumble?
I have not, actually, okay. Now that I think about it. Actually, to be honest, I've never been to a WWE pay-per-view.
Okay, well, that's fair. I mean, yeah. I've been to two Rumbles live in my life. My first ever pay-per-view was 1989 WWE Royal Rumble. Big John Studd wins. One of the worst Rumbles of all time. Got it for the Christmas present. And, you know, it was what it was. I was at the one in San Antonio a few years back. The Royal Rumble live is like the best. I mean, when they only had one, it was a perfect show because you always got a pretty decent Rumble, and I mean, even if it wasn't, if it was decent, you're always into it because you're counting down to 10, 9, 8. You know, you're popping for big moments and this and that. I mean, it's like the greatest hits and stuff. That spread over an hour, but with so many moments, high, you know, crescendos and stuff, because they're really good at doing it, and it will, but usually in the past it had been only one of them, and it was the main event on the show. Having one stuck in the middle of a show just burns your crowd out.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's what happened. And then people are like, oh well, Brock and Finn got the crowd back. Well, they got it back because all of a sudden you have Balor kicking the shit out of Brock and Brock selling big.
Yeah.
Of course, it's a totally different match style and stuff. And the crowd got to sit down on their hands for 30 minutes and catch their breath and come back. So, I mean, it's just, I don't know. I either do the Rumble for 2 days, I think, or make the Women's Rumble. Maybe make the January pay-per-view and all Women's show and headline it with a Rumble.
That would be interesting if instead of doing kind of what New Japan is already doing and splitting Wrestle Kingdom into two shows, if I think WWE would be smart to do exactly that and split the Royal Rumble into two shows before they do WrestleMania as two shows, honestly.
Because, I mean, when you have the same gimmick, you know,
it's a big one that takes up time. It's a big gimmick that takes up time, too. So, I mean, you got two big instant main events that can easily fill, I think, two shows back-to-back. And especially if it's men's and women's, so it's clear that you're going to get totally different. Like, even Wrestle Kingdom, if you think about it, you know that you're going to get mix-ups of a lot of the same matchups. You know what I mean? A lot of the same guys are going to be in the undercard. But if you know that your Royal Rumble is your big match, big main event is going to be completely different rosters, I think easily fill two buildings.
Yeah. And I think it'd be different enough, and it'd be totally two different cards. Besides having the gimmick being the same, but you know, they're not paying me for my opinion.
Do you think that part of it is you mentioned burnout? You also mentioned the crowd just not giving a fuck. Like, is part of it? Could part of it be the booking? Like, could the issue be that while Daniel Bryan is doing a great job with his character, that what he's saying and his alignment doesn't feel like a heel to a certain large segment of, you know, American society, and the kind of stuff that you got with fucking AJ going on right wing talk radio or, you know, Twitter streams talking about that he doesn't understand who the Gillette ad was marketed towards. Like that there's a big segment of the same people who would see Daniel Bryan as a babyface would see AJ as a heel.
Right. I could buy that as an argument if there was some form of reaction to this. You don't understand. There was like no reaction. You can hear pin drops.
Right. Okay.
And these guys are arguably easily two of the top five most over guys on the company. You know, if you really think about it, not including the women, you probably have Brock, Rollins and these two. And then you throw in the women, you could throw Becky, Charlotte, and Ronda, and the Boss and in there too. I mean,
yeah. I mean, it makes, to me, I think it makes sense for what you're saying. The crowd seems like they were disengaged, because I think that the issue is that it's the shoot aspect, it's the background, it's the booking against reality that's causing the fans, who are primarily older and not kids, to have an issue kind of separating, or what is it, like, I can't think of the word right now, but like disbelief, suspension of disbelief to see the two characters in the ring are, you know, are the real people in real life, but it's just like completely separate. So it just makes it so you disengage to even be interested, let alone reacting at all, because you're just like completely unable to, have that suspension of disbelief.
Yeah, I mean, that's a take. It's not a take I'm buying into. I think it has more to do with the fact that they were coming in after the Rumble, because, I mean,
yeah,
we've seen these guys get reaction on TV shows and stuff. Sure. So, I mean,
And then I think the other side of it, something similar and in the same vein, is the reason why Brock and Finn works is almost the same thing, because it's working the opposite way, where if Brock is selling huge for someone the size of Finn, and all of these people have this idea that backstage Brock disrespects people, that he doesn't have, he doesn't respect people in the ring if he doesn't see them as legitimate or have a personal belief that he can draw with them. So the idea that he's selling big for Balor makes people think like, oh, then he must believe in this guy even though he's small, because theoretically he would just not sell for him. So like, it's like weird. I think that both.
And man, if you can't get a David versus Goliath story over, right, and make it work, I mean, you're terrible at your job. I mean,
that's for sure.
It's almost impossible not to be able to get a reaction like that.
And I think that I heard some takes about like the idea that this was Brock's best selling ever. And I haven't seen the match, but I think that it just smacks of people who forget that Brock was a phenomenal seller in his original run.
Yeah.
I mean, matches, stuff, especially with The Undertaker, he was super giving and sold his ass off, but he would do it for everyone. I mean, he got Bob Holly over, like, big time.
Yep.
Like, I heard something recently, and I thought it was, I forgot what it was, but it was, like, talking about that angle with Bob Holly. I remember a spot where, like, Brock jumps out of his skin because he thinks that Bob Holly is coming up behind him or something happens during that angle, and it's believable, and it's, like, that was Bob Holly, and that was how much Brock sold for him. So people forget that he was really good at selling, you know, originally.
Yeah. No, you're right about that. Dean Ambrose gave his notice.
Interesting.
Yeah. You know, I'm not going to say, I don't have any idea why, you know, people want to say he's AEW bound. Maybe he is, maybe he isn't. You know, I'm sure after coming back from an injury, I think he was probably expecting a pretty big babyface push, and then they went in the heel direction, and it just didn't click. And then who knows? But they seem like they'd be more than happy to take him back if he ever really wants to come back. So I don't think that door is entirely closed.
He seems like a guy who could get easily disenchanted, and I think the idea that it was fine. I think it was probably a situation where he was fine with what he was doing in the WWE in the situation because of the way the checks looked when he was a babyface. Because as a babyface, he was remarkably over.
And people, he sold, I think, merch, yeah.
Yeah, people overlook that he was, there was a section of the crowd that were really into him. Kind of the same people who do memes on Facebook that's like a minion dressed up like the Joker. People forget that those people exist and they buy merchandise. So
yeah, no.
And so he made a lot of money as a babyface, and I bet that it's really quickly for him to not be as okay with the situation artistically when the checks aren't as big, you know? So I could definitely see him being like, fuck this. Like, I'm going to get, even though he was a really good heel prior to WWE, I just think he probably doesn't want to be there that much. It's interesting to see where this is going to go. His wife obviously still is going to be working there. I can't see them letting Renee go anytime soon.
Nope.
Although there has been rumors about her being even interested in leaving to go to other sports. But that was hinted at in the past with her husband leaving. Who knows if that would make a difference. And another weird thing to think about it is, I mean, in the pantheon of the WWE, the Shield is a big deal.
Yeah.
And you got Roman out with a big question mark, and you got Dean not in the company anymore. And that's a nostalgia act that you think that they could go back to for a long time based on the fact that it was – you know, three of the only people that they've really gotten over in the 2010, you know,
decade.
Yeah,
when I heard they were reuniting, it almost got me back to watching the TV regularly, but it didn't.
Yeah,
it almost did.
Having like a Shield reunion situation off the table for them would be huge. So he is a guy who I think is lucky that he's got that anchor as being a member of the Shield. That's a nostalgia act that they'll always want to go to, that he can probably take his time, go do whatever he wants. And then they're always going to bring him back because you can get a pop for a Shield thing, you know?
Yeah,
so,
no, yeah. And the Shield is something they can protect and, you know, yeah. And when they need it, they could always pull it out of their back pocket. Now they can't; it's not right quite there, but they can still probably get it. If you know, we'll see where he's at in a year or two or in a while. See, but you know, a lot of opening. I know Kushida worked Tanahashi last night. I've heard good things about it. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm excited to see it. I definitely want to see Kushida when he gets into NXT and the WWE. I really want to see him and Mysterio work a match. You know, that, I mean, of course, that's my dream match, and probably 99% of, you know, everyone else's dream matches that you can do with Kushida. But gosh, yeah, just a lot of interesting stuff going on in the sport. So on that note, when we get into NXT, unless there's anything else you want to cover.
No, I think that's it for me.
Yeah, I thought this was a really well-done show. It definitely was much better than the NXT UK show. So let's get started. It opened up with Strong and O'Reilly versus the War Machine. And War Machine gets this pretty big grand entrance, and I got to admit, it was kind of neat. We see Undisputed Era attack early on, and Rowan Hansen turn the tie quickly. Double team gives Undisputed Era the advantage, and Undisputed Era is using quick tags and double teams. Rowan uses some really cool power moves. A lot of shifts in the momentum early on where no one quite gets the advantage. Hansen does a dive and takes himself out, and then Rowan gets clipped and they get heat on him. Big move galore down the stretch. Crowd was really into it. I felt it felt a little too long. I felt they could have gone away from one or two of the near falls. I felt they got a little spammy at times. Still thought it was a 4-star match. It feels like Undisputed Era. These guys are ready to go to the main roster. I will see. War Machine, good for them. Rowe is just a really strong worker. Hansen at times can be a little too cute for his own good, with some of the little flips and stuff where he can end up hurting himself. The guy's that big and his size, but man, I thought it was great.
He's been wrestling for a while too.
Yeah, I thought this was a better version of the opener from the NXT UK show. What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, it seems that they have their formula kind of down right now, with takeovers being opened up by big tag team matches, which makes sense because you got multiple guys out there. You got big hot action back and forth. I think you do a Southern Tags style, you can always guarantee you're going to get the crowd into it. They didn't do that here so much because it was just a lot more back and forth like you talked about, and no real clear focus or heat segments. But I also felt that if part of what they were trying to achieve here was to get you to kind of expect, based on the way that the match was going, that War Raiders weren't going to win, I think that then they did a good job. I don't know if that's something that should be super important in structuring a match, but that was kind of my feeling. About three quarters of the way through the match, it really felt to me like there was no way that War Raiders were winning because, like you said, it felt like it was going too long. And that was being done just to protect them in losing, basically, is what I felt like what they were doing.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I also felt like, War Raiders maybe should have been a little bit more dominant, even if they were winning. I felt like they should have been more dominant throughout. I heard people saying that they were kind of projected as ass kickers, and I didn't really see that, like wrecking ball types. I really didn't see that in this match. I felt like what they did a good job helping to make kind of the size differential not exist, which I don't know if that's what they were going for, but it worked, I think, in the context of the match.
Yeah, they worked it like they were the Road Warriors in the 80s working the Midnights or Tully and Arn. I mean, with them, they'd be a little bit more Southern, but right. Usually the heels would get a big-time long advantage either by cheating on them and you know, double teams and stuff like that, where they do a lot of selling on the house show. Not ever on TV, but on more on their house show matches. And that's kind of, I think it's kind of like that's what they do here, because I don't think they know how. I don't know. It just seems like people don't know how to book a dominating powerhouse tag team really anymore.
Right. But then what I was going to say was that the one thing, though, is even with saying that and the way that this felt, it's like NXT has done a 1,000-time job better of booking them than ROH did. Because ROH waited so fucking long to get to putting the titles on them that they completely ruined all their steam. And it's like, at least, even if I don't think that this match was the perfect way to put the belts on them, I think that it's at least they're doing it, you know, and it kept them looking strong the whole way through. I feel like the entrance, I get that you like it, and I actually kind of got talked into understanding it a bit more, because to me, sometimes over-the-top pageantry can kind of take me out of wrestling as a sport. But I can see it for a ritual and kind of intimidation factor and everything, and getting yourself hyped up, sure. To me, I think that the only issue I would say with that is that they came out first. And like, I just kind of thought, like, well, you have a cool entrance, if you're doing it to intimidate your opponents, it would probably work better if they were in the ring when you were doing it, right? You know?
Right.
So I do kind of see that as like, maybe a little, but that'll be the difference of them being the champions, right? So that'll be cool if they continue with big entrances with them as the champions, because then you can start to see that as a big-time intimidation factor that they can build on. So I give the match 3 3/4 star. I think it definitely went too long, and I do think that it wasn't the best way to start the War Raiders off as champions.
Yeah.
But I also get that Undisputed Era is probably still very important to them, especially because you've got the proclamation of Adam Cole saying that this is the year that Undisputed Era is going to get all the gold. And then you've got the gold, the other two belts on kind of a former tag team, people that are known as a big time tag team in, you know, on the top. So having the Undisputed Era still strong as a tag team is also probably important for continuing a feud with them too, is what I would expect, honestly. So we'll see where they go moving forward with that.
Then we got Matt Riddle, Cassius Ohno, in arguably the worst feud in wrestling. That's my take, as in it's a feud where you know Riddle's going over.
Right.
And when he's already won, you know, when he's already won two matches, why do you need a third? In 1994, when Ric Flair lost to Hogan the first two times, then they built to this retirement match, or they were building to a third, and none of the tickets were selling. It was because Hogan's won. Originally, well, he won one by count out, Flair did, or did squat key or something. Originally, Flair was supposed to win the second match on Clash of Champions, and then they were going to go to the third one as the tiebreaker. But instead, it was Hogan had won both of them. One was by DQ, and then one was by clean pin. So the third time they go to it, tickets aren't selling, so they end up having to put the stip on that if Hogan wins, Flair would try to sell some tickets. So when you're already 0-2 in the feud, it's hard to get people to buy into it. And I will say these guys worked their asses off, but I thought they had a hard time keeping the crowd at times. It's a feud that is so, and then, you know what, I'm not saying, you know, I understand, like I was arguing with Johnny Sorrow, he's like, well, you know, Hero's the coach, the player coach. I go, I understand the dynamic perfectly, but if you're still, that's fine. But then he loved the whole like Keith Lee angle, which me and you did not like so much. I don't mind him in the player coach role, and I understand that's what he is. But to keep things interesting to your fans, he's got to get something, and you don't want to beat Riddle this early. So I mean, having a third match, it's almost like, so it was anticlimactic, and I felt like the reaction from the crowd was anticlimactic to it. What did you think overall about the match and break it down? I just want to throw my thoughts on that.
No. You're right on all that. And I think that, I think they really shot themselves in the foot with the first angle not being just an angle. You know, the flash knockout in the ring could have been fine without it being an actual victory given to Riddle early on like that. And I think that it was an uphill battle. And something that I noticed during this match that I think hurts it, I don't know for sure, but it looked like, you know, I don't know if Hiro's gained weight since the last time they wrestled or whatever, but it felt like with the gut wrenches that Riddle used to be able to do the rolling gut wrench, and it felt like he was barely able to get Hiro over for the single here. So I'm like, I don't know if Hiro's bigger or not. It never matters. He moves just as well and he wrestles just as well no matter what size he is. But the thing that I noticed in this match that I think really hurts when you talk about credibility is that when Riddle and Hiro had their first feud, Riddle wore just the trunks, and his size, even if he has gotten bigger, would help even more because he's just so much more imposing in the just trunks. And I think that this, especially this basketball jersey bullshit, like, you just can't tell. You can't see how big he is, really. And so you don't get this.
He's wearing the basketball jersey, and underneath it, and then he has kind of like a skin-tight body
suit
underneath.
Spanx on underneath. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, so he's holding everything in. You're not getting the imposing just kind of nature of this gigantic man, this big mass of, you know, how big he is. So, like, that helps with his credibility. That's why he was good on the indies selling right before he came back to NXT, because when he would sell big for someone, it was huge because he had so much credibility from his size, and he was just so imposing. And you have none of that here. You don't really see that, so you just, it's hard to get into that he has any credibility here after having lost twice, and now he's in here and he just looks like a loser getting beat up. And I really do think that would make a huge difference if they just presented him in a way where people could actually see how big he is. So that kind of, I think, really hurts the situation. I get that it's all about what they want. It's funny to say it's the worst feud in wrestling, because, like, the only thing keeping it, I think, for me from saying that is that it has the history, because their feud in Evolve was so good that it's kind of, like, you know, hard to look at it overall as being bad. But, yeah, this feud in NXT has been terrible.
I mean, the work at least is good, you know. That's the only thing going for it. But it's not as good as what it was at the Evolve.
Yeah. So, I mean, solid. It was, you know, really impressive. It's super cool, the stuff that Riddle can do, the stuff with the apron. Obviously, it's like, there was something that someone did recently with the apron catch spot, and I was just like, god, fuck Fit Finley for bringing that, because it's just like, it gets done so trivially now, like, times where you're just like, this is so, it's just such a fucking dumb spot.
Yeah, we've seen Undisputed Era use it. We've seen, obviously, Ono used it here, of course. Finley.
Right, and that's kind of my point, is it gets used on the indies and all over a bunch, and they just do it kind of the same, and it's boring. And it was like, here, Riddle, or not Riddle, but, well, Riddle gets caught in it, but Hiro does it in a way that's interesting and different, tucking Riddle's face in there and then stomping on, and it was like kind of perfect there. And it just shows, like I've talked about, that Hiro's just so fucking great as a wrestler because of his, you know, the way that he can think and come up with stuff. So, you know, it's obviously the work is going to be great, but it's just so tough to watch it this way because you just feel like it's such a waste. And now you got one of Riddle's all-time rivals on the indies saying that this is his last year, and Eddie Kingston announcing that. And it's just, I'm fucking bummed to see Riddle, or this is going to be the way that Chris Hero finishes out his career, like this, while Kingston is on the indies just kind of, you know, disappearing too. I'd love if those guys could have one more big time match. And unfortunately, what we're probably going to end up with is Cassius Ohno having just a bunch of matches until he gets injured by some football player, and then he, you know, on the Largo Loop, and then he just never comes back to the ring. Like, that's realistically what we end up with. So it's just kind of a bummer to think about. The match itself, I gave 3.5 stars. I, you know, like I said, the work is great, but no one's really super into it. And and the dynamic for the story isn't good, but the work, I mean, is fantastic. I mean, facial expressions from both. Matt Riddle is getting even better at selling, I think, than he even was on the indies, just kind of becoming what they want here in a WWE style. And I think the sky is really the limit for him. And it's so funny to think that the only reason why he's in WWE right now is because Meltzer let it slip that New Japan was going to sign him.
Yeah.
It's like WWE would have, I mean, by now, with the way everything is going, he would have been probably signed by now. But it's like, it's so funny that they finally pulled the trigger because of they heard New Japan was interested. And it was like, it's not like he got any better within like the probably the last 7 or 8 months that he was on the indies. He was already as good as he is right now.
Yeah.
So there was no reason to not just have signed him already.
Agreed. And I liked it too. I gave it 3.25. I mean, it was just a hard hitting, nasty, badass, just, you know, hard-hitting match, really good, you know, in your face smash mouth wrestling. Then we got Ricochet versus Gargano, and this is everything you needed to be from these guys and what you expect. Nice feeling out process early on. I thought Gargano's gear was really cool, but man, it's a total babyface thing, not a heel thing to do. So there's that. Ricochet's Aussie climbing the ring post was blew me away. So many wow moments in this one. Gargano destroying Rico's neck and head. I really liked. Really had big moments. I give it 4.5. It was one of them just like. They brought their A game. They brought everything they could and jammed it into a hell of a match. But again, Gargano finally started feeling working heelish towards the finish. And I felt like, you know, they could have gone with a different finish because this is a little overkill. But I still thought, I mean, come on, it's Ricochet and Gargano. This is what they're going to do. And that's what most of the audience wants them to do. So they delivered what they wanted. 4.5. What'd you think of it?
I gave it 4.25. I thought that, they did a really great job making everything feel natural too and still playing it up. There was like the only, and this is saying a lot with the way that Gargano big matches have been recently. The only moment where I was like, God damn it, with the histrionic bullshit was when he teases doing the hanging, you know, the DDT on the concrete.
Yeah.
That was the only, and you know, because of Gargano's great matches that are like authentically great, like legitimately great matches, but they have so much histrionic bullshit that I'm sitting here just fucking, you know, biting my tongue the whole way through at just how annoyed I'm getting. Because the work is so good, like other than that stuff. And it's like, and that's me because I'm like, I'm very, like kind of irony poisoned, as they say, like I'm a little bit cynical when it comes to especially entertainment and media and stuff. Like I'm not a bitter person. I've said this in the past. But I do like stuff like that. That's just a little bit over the top saccharine. I just kind of check out on pretty easily. So the fact that this match had nothing that really had me feel that until that late in it, and it was really small, was like really good for Johnny. Cause that's what Johnny's been doing a lot, but then he still delivers a fantastic match. I mean, Ricochet is so fucking great here with his spots, the stuff that he shows off. One thing that I would say was a little bummer is that Ricochet goes, he stands up out of the Gargano escape and then just kind of tosses, Gargano into the turnbuckle. And it's just a little thing to me because I would have liked the continuity because Ricochet regularly does the Regalplex and he teased a Regalplex earlier in the match. So I would have liked him to have gotten it there just to show that continuity of a character who's focused and that transition and the way that it would just kind of work out perfectly that you go from one position to the other smoothly to actually hit a Regalplex there. That's a stupid little, you know, detail that doesn't really matter. But otherwise, like this match was hitting a lot of really cool stuff, great details, like layered kind of backstory that made sense. I love that they played off of their history with each other, especially because it helped make kind of them having counter for counter stuff make more sense just because you talk about...
Yeah, made the story richer. I totally agree.
Yeah, so the fact that they're willing to talk about these guys have a storied history with each other in the past, you know, outside of WWE to help enrich what the match is going to be was really smart. And one thing that I thought about during this match was just that Ricochet is so fucking crisp and so good at this high-paced action that I understand why WWE will never probably do it, but it's so funny to think, like, that little bit of heel run that we got with him on the indies, he was really good. And it's, like, impressive that he's able to pull off a heel as a guy who can still do high-flying, but I understand why, with just how fucking flashy his offense and everything is and so crisp and amazing-looking, that they wouldn't want to even try to have him run as a heel anytime soon, really. But yeah, I mean, it's just a testament to how good he is and Gargano. And then the storyline stuff coming out of this is really cool. So, like, yeah, this hit in all the best possible ways.
Yeah, no, me and Johnny were, like, kind of arguing about this thing, too. Like, he's a big fan of the whole teasing of the Gargano, Ciampa, and I'm not. I mean, it's like, and he's like, well, you know, I like these long-term storytelling. I'm like, I'm with the long-term storytelling. If I believe what they're selling. And the fact is, they have had blood feuds. They've had bloody brawls. They have hate-filled fights. And now all of a sudden, we're bad fans for wanting to have them back together because they were heels. Now they're heels. And then they're taking for them. They're, like, suckering the fans in on top of it. So I don't like where the story's going, where we're possibly getting a Gargano Ciampa combo. Who knows? But still a hell of a match. Then we got Baszler and Belair. Sam Roberts saying Belair isn't ready for the spot. I agree. I think she's a great athlete, but she needs more seasoning. And I felt that's kind of what happened in this match. But what do you think there, Tim?
I don't disagree with that, but I also think that that was... It felt like they were trying to hammer that story home. So I think that people are kind of giving Sam Roberts credit like he was shooting on air or something when he's signed by the WWE. And I feel like that was probably a corporate talking point, honestly.
Right.
Because that was the story of the match. So I get where you're coming from, and I do think that there's some stuff that was little stuff that I think that wasn't even part of the storyline or wasn't thought of as being part of the storyline that really displayed the same thing. Like, one little stupid thing, the fucking ponytail. It was just, it was such, it felt like an albatross the entire match.
Where you had to hold it in so many moments?
And it just, if I'm going to talk about the War Raiders having their entrance making me question, like, why would a fucking athlete take the time to put on this helmet and get these spears, you know, before their match? Why wouldn't they just be training? Why would an athlete have something that she has to deal with like that on her body the entire fucking match? And so it was just like, it just really takes away from the, you know, authenticness of the character as an athlete. The hair whip fucking causing blood was wild. Do you think, I mean, Shayna's old school enough that I think she knows about, like, blading the body. Do you think that Shayna bladed, or do you think that that was something that they put in her ponytail to help, like, catch her to break the skin? Or
yeah, I think it was unintentional where they, when she got, you know, got a little nick in her, like, stomach area.
Yeah.
But I guarantee it came from the ponytail. I don't think it was intentional, but I think they put it out there so it could happen, if that makes any sense.
Right. Cause she had, like, little rhinestone things in her ponytail too. So maybe something could have caught her, but that was a cool little spot. I thought that repeatedly showing that the only tool that Belair had was her athleticism was good. So, like, anything that she tried to do to counter from holds really just came down to raw strength, and that's only going to take you so far.
Yeah.
I don't know if we needed the Four Horsewomen, honestly, getting involved even as much as they did, which was not necessarily a lot, but even still. I think it, you know, I don't know that... I think with the story being out there and trying to present that she wasn't ready for this position, I don't think that you needed to show that it took help for Shayna to beat her, or even, you know, I think maybe once they could have both come out and one little thing and then that's it, would have worked out a little bit better for that. Cause I think it pushed it too far over the top. Like, that you're trying to tell this story that she could have won. I think that you should have just gone with the basic story that she wasn't ready because she wasn't, she's not there yet, you know, just she all she has is her freak athleticism, and that's not going to be enough to beat someone like Shayna. Shayna was fantastic as always. I mean, you know, there's really so little to say about her at this point other than just what she does with her opponents. And I thought that she did a good job here with Belair, kind of telling the story that she was telling and getting it across, being interesting, giving her enough, and breaking out some cool old school spots with the rolling Pat O'Connor armbar, which was a nice little touch there. I gave the match 4 stars because I really loved the work. And the story that everything that Shayna did. And I thought that Belair looked good. I think that she'd be better off as a heel moving forward still. But I think that she had a good bump in the road here. And I hopefully they can kind of pivot off of that as helping to make her an even bigger heel. Although they might go with it as being a way to endear her to the fans because she's had hardship and she overcomes. I don't know what the plan will be for sure, but I think it could go either way. And I still am. I'm still bullish on Belair coming out of it, and Shayna, I mean, is just, you know, obviously phenomenal. So we'll see how it moves forward. What'd you think of this, Pete?
I'm sorry, I was thinking about something. Well, what was the question? Oh yeah, I enjoyed it. I liked Belair using the hair as a weapon to injure the arm. But I loved Baszler just torturing Belair. I like the dynamic of Belair. I mean, Baszler being the experienced pro, being a 2-time champion, Belair being like the non-Japu, however you want to call it. Well, how do you say it? I can't even say it right. But being like the protege, not protege, but being the person who catches on quick.
Phenom. No, Phenom. Not Phenom.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, but Phenom. Yeah. But being undefeated, and I liked it. I mean, it told a story. I just wasn't all enthralled with the story of, you know, of what they were selling, but they worked hard in it.
Oh, I think you were Prodigy. That's what you were.
Prodigy, yeah, that's what I was looking for. Yeah. And stuff. So, I give it 2 3/4. What'd you give it again, Tim?
I gave it 4.
Okay, and that's fair. I heard a lot of people. I see a lot of people liked it a lot more than me.
Right.
It might be because I'm not a Belair guy. I like her, but I think she's just scratching the surface, and I think she's gonna get better and better and better. Again, I thought this was really a good Baszler match. It's one of those things where I just didn't ever buy Belair beating her. So I think it has something to do with it. We'll take a break, and here we go. Check out ProWrestlingOnly.com, our sponsor, to explore other podcasts along with match reviews, featuring retrospective reviews of wrestling books, video game, matches, playlists, wrestler appearances, and non-wrestling TV shows, and movies and more. You can also join the conversation by signing up at the Pro Wrestling Only forums. We've been online for over a decade, and with over 2,000 registered members and an archive of over 4 million threads, our message board is a vibrant community all its own. Whether you want to talk about a specific match in our match discussion archive, take a deep dive in the Microscope forum, discuss general topics from wrestling's past and present, check all this and more at www.prowrestlingonly.com. And I would say Tom Batista for the what podcast is this again?
Military Industrial Suplex.
I had a really long interview with Billy Jack Haynes where I think they talked for about an hour and a half. So I haven't heard it yet, so I don't want to say I've heard it and it's incredible. So but I plan on listening to it, and I'm not a big podcast listener type of guy. But if you're into interviews, Billy Jack Haynes, though, is a pretty interesting cat. From Portland to WWE to WCW to bodybuilding to steroids to prison to fake comebacks. There's a lot of stuff to cover with the guy. And so, that's
all that you're just talking about his, you know, during his in-ring career time, and then you get into his shoot interview time and his, you know, threatening lawsuits and the wild stuff, conspiracy theories that he's gotten into. I mean, if people think for the younger audience, let's say, fellow millennials, if you think that, you know, the Paul London and Brian Kendrick shoot interviews are fucking wild, Billy Jack Haynes was the OG of being a fucking nutbag on a shoot interview. Yeah. So, yeah, I've only listened to a little bit of it. Very minimal. Like, I think I maybe got 30 minutes in, and he's already talked about going on Chael Sonnen's podcast after a kid that he thought was like, that he saw as like his son had just died, and how that turn made him just like go off the handle on Chael Sonnen, which is like wild out of nowhere story, to talking about selling drugs to everybody in the locker room. Like, yeah, the guy getting in fights with professional level boxers, and you know, he's, I mean, Billy Jack Haynes is a tall tales smith, if you will. So hearing him talk about the level of boxing fighters that he was training with, I don't know if it's true or not. And that's the thing about Billy Jack, is you never can tell what's real and what isn't. When you look into some of the stuff, you find out some of the wilder stories were legitimate. And then meanwhile, you'll find out that some of like the really basic shit he's lying about. So it's kind of cool to check out. Plus he was, you know, he was influential to the Portland scene. Maybe not as big as he thinks he was, but he was, you know, so yeah, definitely a very interesting, interesting interview to check out.
Yeah. He's clearly CAF and stuff, and that is carny as fuck. So, hey, but hey, let's get into the main event here. Ciampa, Aleister Black. What do you think about this one, Tim?
I thought that this was fucking perfect. I thought that Ciampa, again, impressed. I think after the last takeover, where I think it was another, I think for a direct comparison, it felt like, oh, Gargano's in the position to have the better match. Ciampa will be fine, but it's going to, you know, I'm kind of feeling like it's going to start to turn on people, or just in perceived quality, that like Ciampa's going to not feel like he should be the main event guy just because he's not the best, you know, athletic worker, technical wrestler that they have on the roster. And so you just worry because of how many times like failed champions in NXT it's been because they're the champion in the main event, but stuff on the undercard is outshining them, and it's just not happening. I mean, he is bringing it, and I thought that one of the best parts about this match is just based just like on what I just said, he's really using the fact that he's not the best in any way to make his heel title reign matches even better. This entire match he does nothing at all ever throughout the match to make you think that he's better than Aleister Black in any way. Like, you come out of it feeling like the only reason why he won is because he's a sadistic asshole. You know, he's not a better striker. He's not a better technician. He's not a better wrestler. It's just the fact that he's willing to be a complete fucking asshole, you know, attack the leg in just brutal, sadistic ways and just grind on him, taking shortcuts throughout, cheating, you know, getting in the ropes, everything that he does, mocking and just trying to piss off Aleister Black, using his anger issues against him. I mean, it's just, the guy is just amazing as a performer. It's really cool, especially because I was a huge fan of Ciampa, but I felt like I lulled on him and didn't expect this much from him. And so it's like, it's kind of nice having a pleasant surprise of someone that I've liked coming back and me liking him again, almost even more, in a setting where I wouldn't have expected it. The back and forth stuff was great. I thought that Aleister Black was amazing selling the leg throughout. I mean, he really, minuscule a couple spots here and there. If you're really trying to be one of these like insane harbingers of limb selling, that it's, you know, just a fatal sin to ever blow off any limb selling.
I thought he was awesome at it. So
yeah, he had like maybe one or two little spot token spots that you could say, well, that kind of didn't make sense, but it was like,
and he fucking sold it hard at the angle of where they set up for the match for halftime heat.
Oh, nice. Yeah, and I'm looking forward to the halftime heat as well. I liked the water bottle slip. I couldn't tell if that was intentional or not, but I thought it was a cool little thing.
But it was a cool moment, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and it really helped add, because as soon as Ciampa pops, or as soon as he pops back in, Ciampa hits him with the fairy tale ending, and it's just kind of like, God, that felt like it was intentional because of just how perfect it worked out right there. Big Meteora off the apron by Aleister Black just feels so dumb with how bad his knee is, and love the near fall after that was just perfect with how Ciampa just slumps over. And that's all it took because of how bad Aleister Black's knee is fucked up, that he just couldn't get to the cover, to where all Ciampa had to do was a little move that was nothing, to basically he just completely thwarted his attempts at winning this match. I mean, I talked myself up even a little bit. I was already high on this match. You know, I thought that everything throughout, Ciampa doing the schoolboy into the ropes, I thought was so cool, because when he did that in ROH years and years ago, as a schoolboy, where he threw somebody into the turnbuckle, it was stood out to me. It always stood out to me because I had never seen it before, and I thought it was a cool little thing. So him kind of bringing it back here in a different way and using it to set up into another move, I thought was just another cool like little wrinkle that calls back just to the history of my fandom of Ciampa and something that, like, you know, was just nice to have little wrinkles in that you get these investments from having paid attention to someone for so long. Great stuff. I mean, awesome, huge back and forth. The finish was, again, like I said, it just, Ciampa wins and he's the champion and he's the man, but you really do come out of it not feeling like there's any redeeming qualities to him. He's just a pure heel that you're like, even in victory, you dislike the guy. It's like, it's very rare that people don't like winners, but Ciampa has figured out a way to make it so even as a winner, you just don't like him. So yeah, I gave it 4.5 stars. Great stuff. Great, great action. Just super phenomenal match between the two.
Yeah, I went 4. And, I mean, I was hearing online, like, skippable match. The crowd just wasn't buying it. And, you know, I mean, this crowd, I mean, they weren't super hot for it. Don't get me wrong. But they weren't dead for this match by any stretch of the imagination. Now, watch AJ and Daniel Bryan. That's a crowd that was dead for the match. This was a crowd that they had a tough thing to follow. Because, you know, people wanted to see Ricochet and Gargano. But I felt they did a really good job and got the crowd and kept the crowd for the most part. It wasn't super hot, but it definitely wasn't a dead crowd by any stretch of the imagination. I liked Ciampa tugging on the ear early. I thought it was nasty looking. The exchanging of holds early on. Black working the headlock early on. Ciampa attacking the leg and destroys it, and he was fantastic, just working it all over. Black sells it big, did a great job selling it. Ciampa's heat was really awesome at how focused it was, and I loved Ciampa's elbow to the neck. That looked really nasty. Black can't get anything going because of the damage to his knee and leg. I thought they did a great job with the hope spot spreader out for Black. Cutter on the apron was scary looking. Black's comeback was so gutsy. Crowd was getting into the near falls. I really liked it. And then they start teasing a Gargano Ciampa reunion type thing. And I don't know. I thought they'd pull it out, extend it along, but now they're tagging up already at halftime heat. So I think they're pulling the trigger before they're even officially together. And I don't like the fact the story's dictating that they need to be together, because I personally thought these guys were just in a blood feud. Me and Johnny were arguing about this because he thinks it's great storytelling. I'm not into them reuniting again because, A, you shouldn't be rooting for heels to get back together. One. And they've had a pretty, I would call that what they had, was a pretty good blood feud, even though there wasn't true blood in the sense, because it's, you know, 2018. But would you see Roddy Piper and Greg Valentine teaming up? No. And that's what I felt like these guys had here. I could buy it, like, you know, Marty and Jannetty and Shawn Michaels had a big few-time feud. They eventually, you know, formed back together years and years and years later. But that's the thing. It took years for them to be able to... Here, this is not... They've turned down each other on the same calendar year. I just think they haven't earned their teaming up type thing yet. But that didn't take anything away from Ciampa and Black, which was a 4-star match. I'm just a little soured on where I think the story's going here with Gargano and Ciampa and stuff. But overall, I mean, I thought it was an excellent show. If you're complaining about this show, I don't know what to do. I mean, was it a show of the year? You can make an argument for it, I think. I'm not there, but I definitely an easy thumbs up show. What about you? Where do you fall on this one, Tim?
Without any question. And I was shaky on the fact that they were devaluing the TakeOver brand by having that UK TakeOver
Yeah.
Just last week. And it really you know, kind of stinking up the joint. I've been historically down on TakeOver, more than most people. There's people who, you know, every TakeOver has been great since the beginning of time, and right. I don't see it that way. But this was really good. I mean, this was I was hearing people talk about it, like, you know, is this in the elite level TakeOvers? And I mean, I think if I went through and looked at the star ratings, there would be an argument for being it in the second tier at least. It could be
I can see that.
It could even possibly break into the top tier, depending. Yep. I mean, you know, there
I could buy that too.
There was stuff on early TakeOvers that was like, you know, filler. There was just stuff that was just filler. This didn't have anything that felt like filler. You could say that there was some stuff that maybe went a little bit too long, or some stuff that the booking was not perfect, and I think maybe it wasn't as hot as some of the older NXT shows, so that always helps. I think a lot of people...
I feel when they've made the show 2.5 hours versus two, it gave the show potential to have knockout shows, as opposed to when it was 2 hours, it was just a little too short. 2.5 hours is like the sweet spot for NXT.
Right. And, you know, adding the build-up video, promo videos before pretty much every match is good. We'll see if they continue with that being on every match moving forward. I could see it getting a little bit too samey, like main roster shows, if they do that. But it's not bad. So, yeah, to me, great show. Easy thumbs up. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. All right, man. On that note, boys... we'll be gone for the next couple of weeks, so we'll catch you up when we get back. Tim, anything you want to plug before you head out?
No. Just follow me on Twitter at Lucha Undead, and that's it for me.
Yeah, follow me on Twitter at Titanzo Wrestling. Have a great week, folks. Couple months away. You know, hey, have fun watching wrestling anywhere, anyplace, anytime. Later. Oh,